Drums, please. Hi, it's me, Ashkenazi, your favourite North London Jewish queen. I am here to bring to you the secrets from the Pink Room.
Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room. Pink Room, Pink Room, not the Stink Room. Pink Room, Pink Room, it's the Pink Room.
Hello, my bubblers! It's me, Ashkenazi, reminding you that drag queens are for life, not just for brunch. Welcome to the Pink Room, the queerest backstage since Khloe Kardashian went to jail. In the Pink Room this week, we have Mimi Zhu, DJ, director, curator, promoter, fashionista, sound designer, choreographer, dancer, the list goes on. But what makes Mimi stand out is her passion for collaboration and sharing spaces. Together we talked about her new project, Awkward Moments, selling the dream, and being a creative with ADHD. So here it is, Mimi Zhu in the Pink Room, with me, Ashkenazi.
Mimi.
Ash.
Welcome to the Pink Room.
Thank you, delighted to be here.
We're in the beautiful Lalo. You say you've been here before to play?
I have, many times. I did a residency here with my performance project called Awkward Moment, and we stay here for a week and performed here and had a wonderful time.
So tell me a bit about Awkward Moments. What is the concept behind it? And then can you tell me how you managed to get all performers and audience naked?
Oh, you saw that video.
I did.
So Awkward Moment was born out of a charity, actually. My assistant at the time, that was like four or five years ago. That was during the refugee crisis. And she really wanted to put on this fundraise. And she was like, do you want to be involved? I'm like, absolutely. And my idea was just start a band just for the fundraise. And Gillian and I have met a few years before that. And then I'm like, who can I call to be part of the band? Gillian. And I called Gillian and she was up for it. And then we just kind of create a band with a full band with a drummer, guitarist, she on the viola, me on keyboard. And we just, yeah, started on the fundraise. And then it started evolving because she went on tour. And then for me, Awkward Moment is a collaborative project, which means the idea is to collaborate with various type of artists. And we worked with Carlota Guerrera, who was doing all Beyoncé's artwork at the time. She's this prolific director, photographer and artist from Barcelona. And at the time, she just finished the whole Beyoncé campaign, did all the video. And she works a lot with femininity and nakedness and how we feel comfortable with our body. Different body shapes. She was amazing. So we created this performance, another Awkward Moment, in a museum in Denmark. And the idea was everyone gets naked. And yeah, that's what happened. It's about kind of female empowerment. Actually, not just female. There was men and women. And the idea was just, you know, let yourself to be proud of who you are and be. And it was really like healing in a way, because we all have, you know, we all feel uncomfortable about our body. It doesn't matter how perfect, there's always a bit that you're not comfortable. It was really, I'm like, oh my God, can I do this? And once you did it, you're like, actually, everyone's naked. It's normal to be naked. Fine, what's the problem?
I love that.
So that's how we got naked.
I love when acts really collaborate with their audience. I think it's really important. And I've seen a massive shift in gigs recently where there isn't this us versus them approach anymore.
100%. It's about blurring the audience with performances, I think, because a live performance is about engaging the audience. Otherwise, you can just listen to Spotify at home. Sorry, Spotify or any other streaming platforms.
Spotify specifically.
Yeah, no, not really. But you know what I mean. So I think when you go to see a live gig, you want something more than just what you can listen at home. So interaction is key. And, you know, I think a live performance need to find a way to engage the audience. whether it's going into the audience or get on stage or create some contact.
So that's the co-creation you encourage in a gig space. You work in the fashion industry quite a lot. Yeah. How do you see that they're trying to co-create between the model and the audience? Or is fashion a different concept in the sense that you can't encourage co-creation in the same way?
Yeah, fashion is a different story, isn't it? It's quite, in a way, I wouldn't say elitist, but it is, you know, you are watching a show that you can't really touch the model, you can't really talk to them. There's not much of kind of audience participation, I would say. But it's about selling a dream. So selling a dream, you're not supposed to touch the dream, you know. The dream is something that you aspire to, but you're not able to, you know, it's not tangible.
I love that. That's the best explanation I've ever had for fashion. Because while I love watching it, it's hard for me to engage with it, I find. Because
it's not related to reality.
Yeah.
You know, the only bits you can get is buy the clothes. That's how close you can get from that dream. But the choreography, usually, obviously now there are shows that you stand up, and my friend Marnie does these great shows where audiences literally, there's no front row. They're stood there for, you know, until the show comes and the model will walk across the audience. That is the only brand, I would say, that is brave enough to create this audience participation concept. One show they did, they actually got the audience to dress in Marnie as well. They dressed the entire audience in Marnie. And that's great. That it was absolutely hell for the designer and the production team because, you know, when you have to dress 1,000 people, I don't know, that was a challenge. But I love that he's the only one that broke, I think, that barrier between audience and stage. And yeah, I think that's the rare one. But otherwise, yeah, it's a beautiful dream. And I work a lot on music for them, and the music is also a beautiful dream.
So how did you start working in that world?
So I'm a musician. I studied classical piano badly, very untalented pianist, but I tried. However, like, my father is an acoustic architect, so I grew up in music, architecture, theater, operas, concert halls. So music always been in my DNA, even if I was not gifted as a virtuoso pianist. So I kind of study journalism, political science, and because I was in Paris, grew up in Paris, I got invited to write about fashion as a journalist. So I'm like, okay, fine. And why not? And what was great as a journalist, you literally get invited to everything. You live in a bubble. You think you're the shit, but actually, you know, you live on £2.50, but you live the dream.
I've lived with journalists.
You know, you live the dream.
They live the
another
dream.
So I'm like, okay, you know,
sunset
20.
Selling.
Exactly. So I think I got a good eye on fashion somehow. I know, I understand it. It's just quite an effortless métier, you know, like styling. I was styling a bit. I got bored of it. So fashion has always been quite, kind of a second nature. You know, I love clothes. I wouldn't say I love fashion, but I love wearing clothes, combining clothes.
Tell us about
thing.
The look today.
Today, it's a casual, comfortable, but colorful look. I still want a bit of a spring and summer. But
yeah.
I'm towards the end, so I got a little
little knitted.
Yeah, knitted my number. Freebies.
I need more freebies.
Freebies.
So you say you play piano badly. I think that's something that I can relate to, is when you have this classical music upbringing, the way it's taught doesn't encourage the mind to expand.
Absolutely.
I wondered if there's a way that we could rethink the way that classical music is A, taught, but also performed, that it can be more expansive.
I agree with you. I grew up with sheet music. So all I knew was playing what I've been taught and told to play and never really engaged in creativity in a way that composition would, you know, would allow you to do. I think the fact that in classical music you don't even teach just chords, you know, yeah, basic chords that allow you to play around and explain to you why, you know, these notes are there, because I just learned to play because I've been told and I read the sheet and I don't know why I was playing this. So maybe connecting a few basic concepts that allow you to play jazz, that allow you to, you know, jam, but like that was never taught to me. So it took me a while. I'm sure it's same for you, right?
That's, oh, yes. Yeah. So growing up, I did singing lessons, piano lessons, yeah, violin lessons. And it wasn't until I started to play drums that I went outside of those boundaries, the like sheet music boundary, the note boundary. Yeah. And then I jumped onto jazz piano.
Yeah.
And maybe the classical world isn't selling that dream anymore.
I think they actually don't want you to be free, because then you're no longer playing what Chopin told you to play. I don't know if you can. Maybe one day you Chopin is actually the most fluid, I would, you know, composer. You can kind of express more emotion in Chopin, but like Bach, I mean, my God, I suffered so much on Bach. That was painful.
Yeah, because I love singing opera.
Do you? Oh, yes. My God, fantastic.
It's something I did in the pandemic to kind of pass the time, but it's now become part of my act. And there's something about bringing drag to it. It's selling the dream. I'm actually obsessed with this selling the dream thing now. You've really got me onto it.
I think we all need to dream a little bit these days. Reality is pretty grim.
Yeah.
So what else have we got left? So I think that's why fashion shows are still popular, despite the fact that it's an unattainable dream for many. But it's either drugs or dreams. So, you know, dreams are legal.
Drugs and dreams.
Drugs and dreams.
Tell me a bit about your club nights, because we were, just before we started, we were talking about venues and vibes. What is your vibe bringer? Because mine is poppers. I really like to encourage people to have fun through
poppers.
Poppers.
Well, you cannot not have fun when you're on poppers, I guess.
People get headaches, but I just get in this really silly mood and I can't stop laughing.
Oh, absolutely. I think humor is so important in club nights. But I feel like there's a lot of... So our club night called A Strange Night started with kind of a rejection of big, big, huge night. I've been to so many huge, gigantic 3,000 people club nights. It just people don't talk to each other because, you know, there's so many random people. You know, there's no warmth between them unless you're on poppers, but not 3,000 people were on poppers. So the idea for us to create a tiny intimate rave was really interesting. It's also itself is a performance, because we perform each time differently in our club night and we invite lots of guest performers. It's a collaboration with people and it's always a surprise. That's what we call a strange night. Anything can happen. And 100 people would notice it's like a nice wedding. People they meet at bar and then they hook up. You know, I'm like, oh, wow, this is great. And it's very, also we want a very sounds cliche, but very diverse crowd. So no ages, like from 18-year-old to 60, we want a mix of everything. I think a mix of people, is mixed crowd is the best.
Mm.
Few student, few douchebags, few artists,
lots always of queer. Need some douchebags.
You know, you need one or two as a joke. You know, like there's a few douchebag friends you have. You just invite them as well.
Oh, I've had some douchebags, you know, at the club.
Exactly. You need a few. Small percentages, you know, but some.
I've unfortunately never douched at the club, but...
But the douche who come to your club, not actually, they try to become less douchey because they aim for something better.
Well, I'm douching to aim for something better. I just wanted to go back to the classical music aspect again. And how does that sit in your mind now? Is it something that you can bring back into the performance you do now?
Yes, I think the classical background really helped in my composition. So I write a lot of music, even for shows, do original composition for shows and movies, films. So scoring, that comes in very handy. So now that I'm much more savvy than when I was 6-year-old, in terms of musical structure, I would say, I can use what I know about classical music, like chord progressions and all these things, into my composition. So that's very helpful. But I also grew up listening to musique concrète, which is concrete music from my father. He used to collaborate with Pierre Boulez, which is a very famous concrete music composer in France, at this very well-known institute called IRCAM. So I also grew up listening to very strange experimental music, which I never understood as 6 to 10, like why I'm listening to this really aggressive, strange noise that we call music. But oh, it makes sense now, because when you want to create tension, irritation, annoyance, you use these atonal sound. And yeah, so it all come together, what I learned as a kid.
I think that in music is really important, that tension and release. When songs start with some horrible noise and it goes into some beautiful, expansive sound, it's such a beautiful moment, that.
Absolutely.
That process.
To relieve atonalness and clash. I love that, actually. A lot of my classical music, like Gillian, my music partner, she always, it's clashing. I'm like, I love this. This is beautiful.
I'll sit there with an amp and a contact mic and just go around the room and put it against things and then knock. And then play with the amp. It's great fun.
It's fantastic. Yeah. I really want to see your band.
So I do.
Is it still going?
I've got a number of different projects. So I do drag.
Yeah.
And sing opera. I have this show called The Immaculate Misconception of Ashkenazi. Mm. And it's basically the story of my life in half an hour. So I give birth to myself, hence Immaculate Misconception, while singing Queen of the Night. Mozart.
And fantastic.
Taken down a few tones, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that transforms into Queen of the Night, Whitney, but lip sync style.
Fabulous.
So that's a genesis, if you like. The next act is called Religion. And I come out dressed in full traditional Jewish garb and play the violin solo from Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, wow.
And that then goes into a Rich Girl by Gwen Stefani, which I do a full strip to. I then run backstage, pull out this treadmill that I bought online that's folding, bring it on stage, unfold it, and sing Small Town Boy while running in 8-inch pleasers.
Oh, wow. And how long is that performance?
So that's only 18. That's 18, only 18 minutes. Then I come out in as a blue caterpillar and do a full Kafkaesque metamorphosis into a butterfly while singing Casta Diva. Mm. And then there's a big finale where I sing Sempre Libera and I finish with a lip sync of Ariana Grande, Break Free, and there's sparklers and fireworks and
wow,
silver and everything. It's a beautiful half an hour. It's the most painful half an hour of my life every time.
It's almost endurance.
Oh, yeah. It's cardio, endurance, pain, but pure...
Satisfying.
Pure fantasy. So satisfying.
Oh, man.
It's like therapy. It's like a full-on therapy session, which brings me right back to opera, which is... It's become my therapy.
Tell me more.
So just the breathing techniques and the understanding of the body, the need to completely relax every muscle in order to produce the most natural sound.
How did you learn the technique? Because it's very technical, the opera singing.
So as a child, I started singing opera and then my voice broke and I didn't like how my voice sounded when it broke. And then fast forward 10 years and I started playing around with my falsetto range.
Yeah.
And really enjoyed the sound that that made. So found a singing teacher, Daniele Guerra, who teaches at Royal College of Music. And it's taught me to just re-engage parts of the body that I'd forgotten about for singing.
Yeah.
So none of it coming from here, all of it coming from the throat, all of it coming from the chest and the diaphragm.
It's quite physical, isn't it?
It's very physical.
Yeah. Takes... Do you watch opera?
I try.
You try.
It's expensive.
But do you watch? I love operas. Mimi is La Bohème. It's one of the. It's my parents call me Mimi because it's because they loved the opera La Bohème from Georges Bizet. So I grew up with kind of watching operas, and I love, that's why with Orca Moment, the end game is create an electronic music opera. It's about storytelling, it's about drama, it's about costume, but with contemporary music. So
that sounds beautiful. The most recent performance I saw was Satyagraha, Philip Glass.
Oh my God, yeah. How was that?
And you know, it was so beautiful. They had a few items that they used constantly throughout the show to create structures. So they used newspaper throughout the show to create. So if I try and think of an example, they, at the beginning, everyone's holding a newspaper and they all come together, scrunch it up and make a huge monster. It's just...
Oh, wow.
Incredible. There's one bit actually that I hope I'm not spoiling it for anyone. But
too late.
Every cast member has a roll of sellotape.
Yeah.
And they drag it across the stage very carefully. And everyone does it at a different level, creating this wall of clear sellotape.
Oh my God.
And it moves and shakes to the sound of the music. And then the cast members walk through it. It's trying to recreate a protest in South Africa that Gandhi led.
Yeah.
And then all the lights turn red. Some police in riot gear appear from the back of the stage, tear through this newspaper, abseil down, and then get the sellotape from either end and push it together. So they climb, and they climb through. They arrest everyone. Everyone's taken off stage. And then a fairy abseils down from the ceiling, grabs the sellotape and manipulates it as he lifts it into the air into a stick figure. I've never seen anything like it.
Wow, Philip Glass.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
Yeah. It was beyond.
And people singing at the same time as doing this.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I was just visualizing the whole thing.
I think that's why I love watching opera, is exactly that.
Drama.
It's that drama. It's that drama. Costume. It's that music. All of it combined into
this. The story. You're moved by a story. You're not just, it's not just a song. There's a whole storytelling.
Mm.
And I think it's most important, like, more than ever, we need to find a sense of purpose when we do things. Like now, to be honest, like all our song is based on, there's a message. It's never just, oh, it's a cute song. No, we need to tell something to the audience. We need to reconnect our activism. We're a bit asleep these days, I feel.
Yeah.
So in a humble way, we live our activism through music.
I really like that.
We try anyway.
How do you bring that activism into your world, your music world, because the industry is very male dominated.
Yeah.
How do you contend with that? And is that something that you can see changing for positive? And what is your experience of working in, you know, fashion and music, where at so many levels there's a glass ceiling of male control?
Yeah, it's the world is like that, isn't it? In fashion, thank God, we have a big proportion of queerness. Thank bloody God. Yeah, it's still, there's a lack of concern for the rest of the world in the fashion industry. And there are, and again, thank God, it's changing, everyone kind of greenwashing, but it's still pretend, you know, it's fine. I get it. There are changes in the fashion world. In music, yes, it's very male dominated. I remember when I start DJing, literally like guys look at me like, oh, girl DJ, you don't know how to mix. So I had to like be better technically than the boys to be respected. I don't really care about DJing anymore because now with the new software, a moron can DJ. My grandmother can DJ. So that is that's too easy. It's not interesting to me no longer. and that world, you know, now is that, yeah, it's open up to girl DJ, da 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 da. It's also, yeah, it's, I don't know if it's how sustainable it is, you know, to travel around the world in private jets for many. I don't know. So I don't do that personally.
No more DJing then.
No private jets. DJing only very chosen gigs that I think it's okay to do, and I enjoy it with the right people. It's so selective. And also I'm really too busy with my Orca Moment and my composition and my fashion project and stuff. So it's doesn't leave a lot of time.
Are you ready for touring with Awkward Moments?
I think I am ready to tour with Orca Moment because, first of all, what we do for a strange night is always a fundraise. Mm-hmm. Even for a club night, we kind of try to have a sense of purpose to give it back. We're quite privileged. We can live off our music in a humble way, but it's also they're much less privileged and less fortunate than us. So we always do a fundraise. Even the little money we collect is something for others. So that's what we try to do. And whereas songs, there's always a little subliminal messaging. So the way we write the songs, they're almost like a chapter of a book. And each performance, we use different chapter to create a new narrative. So there's a new book coming up. Unfortunately, I got ADHD, so every performance is different. So it's absolutely a headache because we have to rehearse new things all the time. But it keeps it fresh.
Hey, everybody, I'm Dave Holmes.
And I'm Matt McConkie.
And we are the hosts of Homophilia, the podcast where we talk to awesome LGBTQ+ people about the pop culture that they are consuming and loving and the love lives that they are leading. The conversations that we wish we had had access to when we were growing up. The conversations that we would like to eavesdrop on now. But we have them with the coolest people in the world. Like who, Matt?
Sir Andy Cohen himself.
What?
Michael Patrick King, Tig Notaro, Alan Cumming, Jinx Monsoon, and Ben De La Creme. Countless queens from the Drag Race universe. We're asking all of them about the pop culture milestones that shaped them as queer people, and more importantly, who they're having sex with.
There you go. It's the queer conversation they don't want you to have. We're having it on Homophilia every week on the World of Wonder Network. Tune in.
Listen to Homophilia on the WOW Podcast Network or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
How do you try and manage your ADHD and channel it into your creativity? I'm interested to know. Because I know a lot of performers have ADHD. Neurodivergent issues. Yeah. I was just interested to know, is it a struggle to keep focused on projects or is it what keeps you rolling?
So ADHD, what is amazing about this mental illness is when we love something, we're really focused. And because I love performance, I love music, I'm obsessed with it, it's a joy. So I feel very blessed. But if we go to laundry, then that is, I struggle with that. Or normal life, paying bills, I struggle with this. Reading, you know, manuals, total struggle. But in my, in what I do, like even research music, reading about it, music and performance art in general, for me, that it's just, there's so much knowledge. I will never know enough. So it keeps me entertained. So I think it helped me to focus, but then also create this chaotic situation where every show is different and we all have to rehearse new again.
You know? I love the chaos.
Yeah, it's chaotic.
Chaos is good. So we just had London Fashion Week. Did you see anything that piqued your interest?
I've been away. So I've been remotely. So I was doing a gig in Croatia on this island. So also because the Queen's death, you know, so a lot of things been cancelled. Yeah. And lots of parties been cancelled. And I worked on a few shows remotely because I actually, there was flight delay. Therefore, I missed the shows. But I worked on Regina Pio, which has looked beautiful, Michael Harpin. And then I attended Christopher Kane's show, which was really beautiful as well. So these are the shows that I kind of had a pick.
Tell me about the Croatia island.
Oh my God, that was crazy. So it was an island an hour from Dubrovnik. It's an island with a monastery, like a 16th century monastery, and the party was in that monastery. It was unusual, I would say.
That sounds amazing.
Quite hard to get to.
They have this ability in Europe to organize events in weird places.
And there are so many of them. I would never have gone to this Leeuwpoort Island if it was not for this performance I did. It was great, but it just, I woke up at 7 there and I landed at, I arrived home at 4 p.m. So it's a quite far, it's quite hard to get to.
Yeah.
It's two buses, boat, flights, and you know, it's a lot, but it was great. I don't regret it at all. I had such a good time.
There was a festival I did in an island just off the coast of the Netherlands called Vlieland. And it was watching all these bands trying to get their gear onto this tiny boat was both hilarious and...
That is exhausting logistically.
Yeah, but once you got there, it was just this beautiful space and just had the most beautiful time. What club nights have you got coming up in the...
So the next one... We're not really allowed to say this, the space, because the club is a secret club.
Oh, okay.
The venue, we're not allowed to take photos. It's like a sect in there. But it's Central London. Will ask permission if I can actually reveal it maybe later on to you. Yes, I can privately. But
and
not to these millions of audience.
And what can we expect?
We can expect, because during Freeze... going to be during Freeze the art fair, we push a performance art concept on that night. So we have a couple of performance artists coming to play. We have DJs, but it would be quite arty night.
Intimate,
very intimate. You always hook up in our night. Always.
If you're
single, you need to come. You're coming. You should perform.
I need to hook up
a performance.
Hook up at a night. Thing about drag is it's hard to hook up, I find. And I'm always out in drag these days.
So would you take off the drag after and be Ashley yourself?
I don't think I can.
Mm.
In a night when I'm doing drag, I think de-dragging would really put me back at a level where I can enjoy the rest of the night.
Yeah.
It's almost like becoming completely sober again. It's a very strange process.
I see what you mean. Therefore, you struggle to hook up because who are we hooking up with? Is it the drag Ash?
Yes.
Or is it Ash?
And I think that's my major struggle now is trying to find... the Ash that isn't the drag Ash.
Yeah.
Because the drag Ash plays into so much of my everyday, into like my confidence and my performance and everything that I enjoy. So finding the time for real Ash is, you know, it's slightly harder.
It's a process, isn't
it?
You know, we're a very good friend with Tom Glitter,
Yes.
who kind of said goodbye to his drag persona.
Yes.
And took him a while, but I think he found his non-drag character with a bit of a drag in him still, but yeah.
Because I've seen Tom Glitter, Tom Rasmussen, go through that process from, you know, when they started doing drag at Cambridge.
Yes.
In denim. And yeah, going through that process of exploring their gender and exploring how they perform. And I'm pleased that they have found some inner peace in a way.
Yeah, they feel very comfortable. Well, Tom performed at one of our Strange Nights, and the outfit is it's still reminiscent of drag, but purely Tom Rasmussen, which is really beautiful to watch and very comfortable in their skin. And
yeah, I think I'm still getting there.
It's a work in progress. We'll have a bit of a drag in this.
Yeah, what is your drag?
So my go-to look is the lesbian architect. I love that look. So I always dress like a lesbian architect. That's my drag. And then I go slutty when... Slutty is kind of... It's a look that it rarely comes out, but when it comes out, it's quite satisfying. I think that's my drag. The slutty look. It's rare. It doesn't come out very often.
I think I have to see both of these looks. Talking of lesbian architects, I sat on my Grindr profile to be Edna Mode during the pandemic. And that was a great experience because suddenly I was on Grindr and I was no longer myself. Because Grindr's quite...
Oh, yeah. Quite so are you in drag and Grindr or are you Ashley Cooper?
No, I'm Ashley Cooper.
Here we go.
Yeah. But that's exactly the problem is like, why can't I go out and hook up? Normally, I'm using this bizarre, secretive app to find my pleasure sexually.
Yeah, interesting. And you've never found pleasure with the drag? Or rarely? Like, people hit on you?
Yeah, people hit on me. But it's always the bisexuals.
The confused.com.
Yeah, I love bisexual boys, but sometimes they are confused.com.
Yeah, so but in the morning, the wake up, how's
Oh, I'm not there in the morning.
You're not there.
No, I've left like
hit and run.
Yeah, and also like, so I forgot underwear today, which was.
It's fine. You
know, it's fine.
We're in a private venue.
Yeah. So I've had to, you know, get the gaffer out and really pull it back in case I just, you know, I've crossed my legs. It's fine. Yeah, yeah. Like, we'll be fine. Yeah. But yeah, just like trying to untape at the boys' bathroom and...
Is it painful?
Oh, yeah. Very painful. Drag is painful.
Isn't it? You're right. It's like therapy in many ways. How did you start? Like, what was the first...
So I think I've always done drag. Yeah, in my younger years, I was always the woman in the school play. Makes sense now. At the time, I was like, oh my God, why am I always chosen as the woman? And then when the hormones hit in, you're like, well, no, I can't be seen to be doing that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it was almost like a natural thing to just return to your child self. It's something that I think about quite a lot because I... have worked with children and I have worked with adults, and I sometimes work with adults in a more corporate setting and encourage them to think more childlike. And it's amazing what comes out from that process. Amazing how they think about the work that they do when they think in a childlike state.
Yeah. How about your parents? Like how did they, because you're Ashkenazi.
Yes.
On my dad's side, my grandmother is actually Polish Jew Ashkenazi, so I can relate to that side of your heritage.
So you've got all the parental
nightmare.
All the kind of, so you got the Jewish neuroticism, which I definitely have. What would be,
so got the Chinese dragon mum.
Yeah.
And then the French kind of vanity side.
Hence lesbian architect.
Lesbian architect, exactly. It's an interesting melting pot. And I grew up in Denmark, which then you get this confused.com moment where I'm the only non-blonde kid at school. So always an outsider, but in a way, at home everywhere.
Outsider everywhere and also at home.
Home everywhere. Wow. You had to. Survival.
Yeah, survival of the fittest, right?
So how did you come out to your Ashkenazi parents? And
so I never had a coming out moment. Mm. I didn't feel it was necessary for me.
Yeah.
It was more this kind of slow process where, you know, just would start talking about things with them, started doing drag. And at that point, it's kind of obvious. But the thing is I've got two younger brothers and we're all queer.
Oh, you can blame the parents. You can. It's your fault.
I try not to, because
they know,
like, queerness is, I think it's in my bones. I don't think it's, you know, if I think
it's true. Yeah, I see what you mean.
If I think back to my childhood and, you know, it was an automatic thing that I was chosen to play the woman in the school plays.
It was instinctive.
Yeah.
No one have taught you.
No, yeah. Absolutely not. The other thing is, my friend came round to my parents the other day and was, my mum's clothes are everywhere in the house. And she was like, no wonder you're all doing drag. There's like...
Oh, your brothers as well?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow. Do you do it together sometimes, like a performance?
We are working to bring something together. So they all do very different styles of drag, but we sometimes all go out together and all pull a look, and it's beautiful. It really is.
Wow. The family.
Yeah. Do you have any siblings?
I'm an only child.
So another
layer of neuroses.
Layers of neuroses everywhere.
Yeah, it's endless. But I love watching drag shows. In Paris, I remember there is, I was actually super moved. They have this drag show. Is it Madame Arthur? But they had these beautiful drag queens. Some are disabled, so one has one arm, but in the most beautiful drag, but singing the English equivalent of singers, you know, Elliot Smith, I would say, like really non-drag songs, really beautiful. They would sing in Jacques Brel, you know. It was, wow, I was in tears. It was so beautiful, and the way they delivered the song in such a sensitive and moving way, it was much more powerful than if they were singing Beyonce, I would say. That was a really interesting, like if you sing Nick Drake, like, people would cry.
This is my fear with drag, is that it's becoming
a cliche.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hope that we, you know, look back to some of the elders of drag, like Klaus Nomi or Jane County, or and there are lots of other people doing more punk things, more out of the box drag, but it's harder to push through at this point.
So I was fortunate enough to collaborate with this, I would say, the pioneer of drag, which is Lindsay Kemp. Lindsay Kemp was the Pygmalion of David Bowie. He taught David Bowie drag, costumes, staging technique. Basically, he was inspiration behind Ziggy Stardust. He did all the costume, the whole glam rock. He was a pioneer of the London swinging 60s of that drag glam look. He's a choreographer, and he basically got into, kind of lost his ways, I would say, in the 80s, and decided to move on in Italy. And it was also an awkward moment collaboration. So somehow I was like, oh my God, I dream to collaborate with Lindsay Kemp. And my friend somehow knew someone who did a documentary on him. And they're like, we can contact him. Maybe he can, you know. So I'm like, okay, he's in his late 70s. He was in his late 70s. And I got the opportunity to create a performance in this I wouldn't say the name of the venue, but it was a strange venue for it. And they were expecting me to put on the fun show. They had no idea what I was doing. So I contacted Lindsay Cam and we I was composing the music, and we did it remotely. And then he came to London to perform with us for this performance. And that performance was divided in a few chapters. It was birth, growing, maturity, decay, death, and rebirth. And I'm like, which chapter? I didn't want to be presumptuous to say, you know, you should do the death chapter. He said, no, I'll take decay and death. I'm like, oh, really? Really? Are you sure, Lindsay? He said, yes, you know, I live death every day. Oh, my God. Okay. He came, he was in so much pain. He came, but he taught us, because that was a more dance-focused performance. The series of commitment was, I had contemporary dance involved. He taught us so much. Even his body was not able to move. He put his paint on, white face, his lipstick on. He didn't need much, a red nose. And just the way he hold his hand, he looks at the light. It was so moving. We're all kind of in tears. And he, old school, taught us how to bow. He was very disciplined with us. We were like, oh my God, what's going on? And it was an incredibly beautiful experience. And we were very honored to be able to collaborate with him. And he passed away a few months later. That was his last performance.
Wow.
We were talking about doing a tour with him because he really enjoyed this performance. And yeah, we had loads of fun, but yeah, he sadly passed away. So yeah, I was very lucky to be able to work with him.
So collaboration is obviously a cornerstone for the way you work. How would you encourage other artists to collaborate? Is it just that initial process of reaching out to people?
First of all, I think it's about we need to put aside our narcissism. And in the art world, in the music world, it's so much about me, my name, nah, nah, nah. And I feel
as in Mimi.
the only child. I think I'm trying to get away from this narcissism. I encourage collaboration because I think together we can make something better. You know, it's not like, you know, there's a lot of artists, they use collaboration, but actually it's just to push them and use people. It's not collaboration. Collaboration is actually we all shine together.
I think that is an incredible way to work. How does that happen practically? Because that's where I struggle. I think I'm scared to reach out.
I think if you genuinely say it's a collaboration and we combine skill and we make things better together, people always, we rarely got rejected because the idea is not to, hey, we're using you for us to be better. Actually, we're making this thing together, and let's all make this. That's why it's called Awkward Moment and not Mimi Zoo. Mm. Mimi Zoo, narcissistic, she's got her own shit going on. That's fine.
She's doing great.
She's doing fine. But there's so much joy in collaborating. When you put in, like, this called Awkward Moment, it's no one's name. We're all, like, it's a collective. And it's me and Jalyn, the founding member, but we're open to various collaborators. So, it's always been, it's never been a no yet. And unless people don't have time, but that's...
When people reach out to you for collaboration, what do you look for?
So we look for, is it something that's right for me? Is it what I want to do? Like, I would say, like, some brands will reach out to me to do. It's not right. It doesn't work with the ether. No matter how much money you're throwing at me, unless it's a billion, I would say no. So it's about being selective what you associate with, and if that is in line with your ethos, I think that's important.
When are we going to collaborate? Apart
tomorrow.
From right now, should we do tomorrow?
Tomorrow. You should come perform in Our Strange Night. 20 minutes.
I'd love to.
We can talk about this offline, but it will be great.
I love conversing and podcasting for this reason, because it just leads to I think conversation leads to collaboration in itself.
Absolutely. Who were your most memorable guests?
I have memorable guests for good reasons and for bad reasons.
We don't have to name, but
we
the bad
have
ones.
To name. I think my most memorable guest would definitely be Ezra Furman. Because I knew Ezra in 2014 when she was hadn't come out as a trans woman, and also she wasn't engaging so much in her religion, and equally I was not out of the closet and not doing drag, and we did this tour together.
Oh.
And
you were in your rock band.
Yes. And I think our conversation and friendship was quite stunted then. Fast forward 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Mm. And we had the opportunity to do a podcast together at a festival. And it was, in many ways, the first time we'd actually conversed about what we were doing then and how we were now. And the transformation for both of us and the freeness and honesty between us was just so beautiful. My least favorite podcast was when I started to tell a story about a celebrity, and the guest was like, "Oh no, I know this person. They're a good person." And I was like,
"Oh,
that's a bad way to start a podcast."
Was that at the beginning of the podcast?
Yeah. So never really clawed back from that.
I'm going to listen to that one as soon as I return. But a bit of controversy is quite fun, no?
I love a bit of controversy, yeah. But
that was
it was online. The internet signal was bad. It just didn't really. It wasn't collaborative.
Yeah. It wasn't a conversation.
No. Mm. Which was a shame because I was really interested to know what they had to say. And I think there was a level of narcissism there that disrupted their ability to be honest and open in this format.
Yeah.
And I'm not expecting everyone to be honest and open in this format, but I think that's what I enjoy about doing this, is being able to talk about upbringing and how that...
Yeah, it's an intimate conversation in a way.
The intimacy.
I'm not going to tell my darker secret, but you never know. Get me a few poppers.
Yeah, well, I mean, we could pop some now. Is there anything else that you would like to add before we switch off?
I think, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
I really enjoyed this conversation. And yeah, let's collaborate.
Let's do it.
Thanks to Mimi for spending time with me in the Pink Room. I can't wait to get into a room with her and collaborate. It will be explosive. The Pink Room is a World of Wonder production, produced by Michael Pressman and Chris Kearns, and edited by Jesse Caron. Thanks to Pip Rousson, Tati Pozuela, and Nina Madley, who engineered the podcast. I'm Ashkenazi. If you enjoyed The Pink Room, please subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends. And remember, Queens, what happens on tour definitely gets shared in The Pink Room. Ta-ra for now!